New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Scott Campbell from the Stupid Things for Love podcast. I have a 7-year-old son, and the biggest mountain I climb every day is trying to put shoes on this child. And I'm so grateful to Skechers for making the only shoes my son will willingly put on by himself. Their slip-ons are amazing, and he doesn't have to deal with laces, he doesn't have to deal with anything. They come in the perfect color blue. Thank you, Skechers, the comfort technology company. And you can find Skechers everywhere. Skechers.com, a Skechers store, or wherever stylish footwear is sold.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're back for part two of our discussion of the defense against the Chargers. Mighty fine discussion with Alec Poulianos of One Winning Pod in the first episode. If you didn't catch it, please do. We'll tell you a few of the things that were on. Alec, thanks for joining me again.
Thanks, Ken. Definitely a good game to go over with you because the defense had a lot of moving parts with Roquan being out and, five defensive linemen, interesting use of the dime and all that good stuff. So it was a good conversation.
Yeah, a lot of stuff happening in the secondary. This four-corner dime that the Ravens have moved to is very new. We talked a lot about Malik Harrison, who had a great game. We're probably not done. No. In terms of the game that guy had, a wonderful game from a lot of perspectives, one of them being versatility to play outside and inside linebacker in the same game, which to me is just remarkable. Some of the Ravens' success against high DVOA teams we talked about, the Ravens' chance to win the division and relative to DVOA, the big matchup they have coming up with the Eagles. It's all in that first episode, along with some of the strategy stuff that came up in this game. And I think a game where we kind of both agreed John Harbaugh badly outcoached his younger brother.
yeah, for sure. He's a good one. Even when we get a little frustrated, he's a good one.
Yeah, there will always be that component in every city. And by the way, I know everybody, the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence, particularly with regard to coaching. But for the people who love Mike Tomlin as a coach over John Harbaugh, you are really fooling yourself. Mike Tomlin he's not a boomer even with regard to the advent of analytics. He's a silent, in terms of the things. That's the generation before boomers. Yeah. It consistently leads the NFL in cowardly punting, and it would just drive us nuts. As a franchise, have Lamar Jackson, you're the greatest Ferrari of a quarterback that you've got. You've got Derrick Henry, who's the Mack truck of a running back, and you can't figure out how to go for it on fourth and two. Then you got a problem. So I know the grass is always greener, but there's another contingent out there in Pittsburgh who, by the way, every week that the Steelers lose, talks about firing Mike Tomlin, and they have been set in their ways. Some of them ever since the 2010 Super Bowl loss. So some of them have literally been 14 years of, we need to fire Tomlin. Started as late as 2011 when they got Tebow to the playoffs.
It's incredible though, that they are such a successful franchise and he's like clearly a good coach, that he is overcoming these shackles he puts on himself when it comes to fourth down and 2-point conversions and all the analytics in the game. It's really impressive. If only,
Well, I do feel like there's almost now a game of no limit hold'em being played between the Ravens and Steelers with regard to the longevity of these two coaches. That each really wants their coach to be the obvious Hall of Famer, and both of them are going to make it. I mean, I don't think there's really any doubt at this point about it. Maybe Harbaugh needs another Super Bowl. Maybe not. He's certainly been incredibly successful with what he's done, but I think he will go. But I think that the Ravens and Steelers both jealously guard the longevity of their coach being, you know, at the very top of the NFL as a whole. And in terms of the one team group, but also, you know, in this rivalry, it's another component of it.
That's a very interesting call out. And I think they're going to win it because it does seem like Harbaugh's acknowledging his age, you know, and
right.
I think he made a comment. He doesn't think he'll be coaching the team in 10 years. Right. So like we have some bit of a time horizon that we're looking at here with John Harbaugh. So, yeah, that's a good point, though. I bet you there is a little bit of that going on, similar to when we extended Justin Tucker and then they gave Boswell a contract like a week later.
Mike Tomlin is only 52, by the way. He's 10 years younger than Harbaugh. So
yeah.
He is likely, if it's straight mortality considerations or you know, working lifetime considerations, he certainly could outlast John. But anyway, I'm happy with the way things are situated. Let's talk about the pass rush. Here and what happened for the Ravens, because it wasn't a good day for the Ravens pass rush, but it wasn't a good day for the Chargers passing game either, which is a very unusual combination. The Ravens allowed 18 ample time and space opportunities on a total of 40 dropbacks, and they only had 12 pressures. Now, if you remember, I've said this in the past, but 2-1 or 1.5-1, 1.5-1 is probably a really nice sweet spot to be in. You want 1.5 pressures for every ATS you gave away. So if the Ravens giving up 18 ATSs would have to have 27 pressures to be in a really good spot relative to that. Well, they didn't. They had 12. So it was a terrible ratio of pressure per dropback.
Very interesting. Yeah, I think we commented, if you looked at the advanced stats of the Chargers defense, they have a fascinating pressure situation as well. They're like 30th in the league in pressures, but 5th in the league in sacks.
And like, wow, that doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't. No, it's absolutely absurd. So like the efficiency
is that a PFF thing? PFF pressures?
No, this was from Pro Football Reference.
Okay.
And their advanced stats page. But yeah, it was blowing our minds. We were literally like, we couldn't stop looking at it and talking about it on the show, where if you looked at it, it just doesn't make any sense. But yeah, so they were very efficient with their pressures, obviously, and able to convert them. And I felt like we had a little bit of a similar situation going on with the Ravens when they played them, where although the ratio was very poor and it was super frustrating to see, you know, four not getting pressure so often, I do feel like each of those pressures had very good impact on the plays.
They did. They got in there and they got sacks.
Yep.
But even on the pressure play, so they had 12 pressures in this game, 30% of the total, which is too low. Herbert wasn't too bothered by it. 71 net yards, despite 3 sacks on 12 plays. 71 net yards. That's 5.9 yards per play, which doesn't sound great, but my expectation for a pressure is only 3.5. So he was actually 29 yards above his expectation on the pressure snaps. So maybe this is a game that's, boy, they should have gotten even less pressure.
and then I guess maybe it was better. The ball out quick plays where I felt like he struggled a bit. And that's what it shows in your stats as well, yeah.
Yeah, and he had 10 of those, 25 yards, 2.5 yards per play. Should get about 6. So he's about 35 yards below his standard there. But ATS also, ATS and pressure, there's no real difference. 5.9 yards per play on either, and about 47 yards short of standard on ATS, where you're supposed to get about 8.5 yards a throw. Mm. So he was a lot worse with ATS than he was with pressure, and that's where most of his negative for the day came in. He underperformed his opportunity set by approximately 53 net yards, 202 actual, less 255 expected. So his there were other factors involved. We all know, we all watched the game together. There were some misthrown balls. He missed a ball to Palmer that could have changed it. There were other drops, and if Quentin Johnston had been replaced by inanimate carbon rod or whatever. That's a Simpsons reference, folks. It could have been any number of replacements for Quentin Johnston, which would have improved the Chargers offense.
Oh, Quentin Johnston. I was so happy when they drafted one ahead of us. I really did not want to get him. And then we got Zay Flowers, and life's been very good.
Darn the luck.
Yeah. Darn the luck. Yeah. But anyways, definitely was not his best game.
So I think Orr knew that the four-man rush was not generating the pressure that they wanted it to. And honestly, the Chargers have good tackles. So where the Ravens are best as pass rusher with Van Noy and Owe, they were having trouble getting home with great regularity against Ault and Slater. But anyway, it was a case where Orr used 11 rushes of 5+, up to 28% in this game. It was only 13% against the Steelers last week. So that's a big increase. It's still not at what I would consider a normal NFL level, which is around 30, but it's a fair amount of 5+ man rushes. The other thing they used is a lot of deception in this game. And they were generally successful in terms of yards per play with that deception or with the blitz, and generally not successful with getting actual pressure results, which is a strange dichotomy again, but it is what it is. Herbert just basically had time to move around the pocket. It was how well that coverage was blanketing those receivers that I think dictated a lot of what happened in terms of intentional overthrows out of bounds and whatnot.
I think you bring up a great point with Slater and Ault. The expectation was not to get 2.5 sacks out of Owe this game, right? Like he had last week. The hope was kind of like we were saying, maybe you could get some covered sacks. Maybe you get some pressure on the interior with Bozeman struggling. Maybe you could find opportunities there. But those tackles, that they have so much draft capital in those tackles, and it's really proven to play out well. A lot of teams will swing and miss on that. They have two good ones. So that's a good recipe for their protections.
Very frustrating draft this year, because as soon as Ault was taken at number five, I think five or six, wherever he was taken by the Chargers, it was a pretty clear indication the Ravens weren't going to get a tackle at 30. The field would have been severely depleted by the time the Ravens picked at tackle. And that turned out to be exactly the case. The last, theoretically viable first round left tackle was Guyton, who went right ahead of them to the Cowboys.
Yeah.
Fortunately they got Wiggins. Great, great consolation prize, but we'll see how it works out in terms of how they are able to move on to their next generation of tackles, whether that means Rosengarten is part of it or not. And that is, by the way, a question we'll answer tomorrow on the offense show. We'll have another data point for you on the offense show.
Awesome. Yeah, the tackle draft too this year, I hear, is not the best. So last year was the year. So we'll see how it plays out. Maybe there'll be a diamond in the rough we all discover later on, but early reports are not that. But defensive line, apparently very good, which is great because I think we could use that. But
we're definitely getting long in the tooth on the defensive line, so that it'll be a good year to make that happen. What else do I want to talk about? I'll talk a little bit about the pass rush by numbers results here really quickly. Just take me a second to get there. And so they rushed 27 times, 4.7 yards per play, 3 sacks. They rushed 5, 10 times, 4.6 yards, no problem. They rushed 6 once, incomplete. None of those are any problem. Now, where do they have a problem, you say? Because overall, they gained slightly over 5 yards per play, 5.1 yards per play, and none of these are over 4.7. Incredibly, it was the last two plays of the first half where the Ravens rushed 2 men on the second to last play of the half, dropped 1 to coverage, and we're playing with 8 in the secondary. That's when they had the quarter on with Marcus Williams, and they allowed 11-yard completion anyway by the right sideline. So I think maybe Orr might have learned a lesson here at the last, but the very next play, he had a 0-man pass rush with 4 dropping from the line of scrimmage. So basically, the Ravens were saying, go ahead and try and complete a pass against our 7 on the back end. We're going to sit back here and make sure Herbert does not escape the pocket for a run. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they didn't need a whole lot of yards. Maybe they needed about 10 yards to get into field goal range. And, they ended up kicking it, I guess, it might have been 52 right at the half. And so they didn't need all of that. Yeah. Maybe they could have gotten about 6 yards less, and they really didn't want Herbert to get it. I just don't think that was that great a trade-off. I thought they should have had people going after him and at least getting Herbert to move around. One of the advantages of being a little further back towards the line of scrimmage is the quarterback usually will not be able to get a running start up to the line of scrimmage to release a ball into the end zone. And from that distance, that would have been a factor. So that might have been part of the reason they decided on it. I'd love to hear Zach explain that zero man rush at some point, because it was weird to me that they decided to do that. And of course, he took his time, and then he threw a bullet, a fastball right down the middle of the field that was caught by Palmer, right? Palmer on the crossing route?
Yeah, it was Palmer.
And that put him in the field goal range. And at that point, it seemed like three big points. It didn't end up being all that big in the game.
It was super frustrating, though. I think one thing we kind of haven't spoken about on this show is just, to me, it was the bookends in the middle right there. Kind of like the buns of a Big Mac or something, where the first drive, they don't even get the third down. They march right down the field and score a touchdown. Super frustrating. You give them 24 seconds, and they figure out a way to get in the field goal range.
Uh-huh.
Just like unacceptable. And you're just like, you feel sick to your stomach. You only have 1 point lead. And then the last drive, I know that it didn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. You're up by 14, but you can't get out of your own way on fourth downs twice. You got these penalties, mm-hmm. extensions, and it's just reminders of the problems this defense has at times. And they're at the perfect times to get you like to remember them. You have the anchoring bias of the first drive. You have a drive where they should never have gone away with it with 24 seconds right after a big drive by your team. And then the last drive where, you know, it's the game's basically over. It's out of hand. You know, they have four down football on their side, but you still, in a way, shot yourself in the foot and then stop them. And that just, it kind of hurt. It kind of gave a bad taste in my mouth. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, Ken, I don't know if you saw this, but Orr got a game ball from Harbaugh. But it was the most ridiculous set of preconditions and post-conditions given to this game ball. It's like, well, we spot them 10 points, but then they only scored 6 until the last 7. You know, the final drive. You know? And like, it's like legitimately
except what was that? Except for those 17 points.
Right. It's like, we spot them 10, then we figured it out. It was only 6 points. And then we give them 7 at the end, just, you know, a little icing on the cake. And I'm just like dying from this explanation. And like, I can understand the appreciation of the middle part of the defense there, right? Because at this point with the defense, you are looking for these small wins and looking mm-hmm. for a little bit of progress and things that you can build on. And at the end of the day, the 7 points at the end of the game, really, like, it's not that interesting, all things considered. But the 10 really were, and particularly that three almost hurt worse. They both really hurt, because the 7, you know, like I said, they didn't even get the third down. It was just super frustrating. Right. Anyways, I really hope to see Orr be able to figure out and learn. You know, he's getting little scars every single game. And I'm hoping that they're all building and he's all learning from them, and it'll help impact the flow of plays and the way he approaches play calling, because I think that's the biggest thing missing in his game. And it's understandable because he's never done it before.
Yeah. I think if I were Harbaugh, I would have said it differently. I would have said, hey, look, we were short a lot of players today. We didn't have Roquan, and he had to figure out how to get by with the talent he had. Not only did he get inside outside play out of Malik, who just got the first game ball here. Yeah. He also got Christian Welch a start. First NFL start, Christian, congratulations. You don't get a game ball, but congratulations. Chris Board, 30 whatever freaking snaps it was. You were a big part of the pass defense as we went down the stretch in this game. Congratulations. And of course, Malik, you played some great off ball linebacker as well. I mean, if you just went through that, I think you'd be fine. I think if you know, we took away from this guy the ability to play a three safety, three corner dime. And I don't even care if I'm embarrassing Marcus Williams, who's in the room at this moment.
Right.
But we took that away from him, and we went to this four corner dime, and he still made that work. And look what Justin Herbert threw for 5.1 yards. But I think there are a lot of things you could have pointed to that wouldn't have to be except for the kind of things, which you hear all the time is with Jim Brown. Well, if it wasn't for the 60 and the 32 yard run, we really held him pretty effectively today. You know?
Yeah.
All right. Deceptive elements, we'll talk about that very briefly. Off-ball blitzes, they had 13, two doubles, 0.33 per play. It's a very high number for the Ravens. They hadn't been blitzing much off-ball. And we talked about this in the first episode, but there is a concerted effort not to give away your blitz that I really liked in this game. The Ravens, in particular from the slot corner blitzes, had been giving it up early, creeping to the edge of the line, and that's true at safety as well. That can happen. Yeah. They did a great job in this game. They blitzed cornerbacks 8 times in total, and they all are listed on my deception list, which means they didn't give it away early. So they weren't within 1.5 yards of the line of scrimmage, or they weren't inside of their spot opposite the slot receiver. So very good job for that. I'm sure they were thinking about that. Only 4 stunts in this game, all singles. Now, one of the things, if you blitz a lot, you probably will stunt less, because when you blitz, you can't have an on-field stunt called. I have also kind of felt, I know how you feel about it, Alec, that the last couple of weeks, Herbert, not a huge running threat, but a little running threat. Wilson, not the threat he once was, but they still perceive him as a threat, and they want to keep him caged in the pocket, funneled. It seemed to me like in both of these cases, they want to keep people all around Herbert and keep all the exits barred. And what they didn't really do, and I thought they could have done, they did a better job with Wilson, but they could have done more of, is you can get tall against Wilson and keep your guys in the middle and keep rush lanes blocked. Don't accidentally open rush lanes by stunting. In the case with Herbert, there's no real opportunity to do that because he's too tall for that. But you do have the opportunity to keep the exits blocked from him as a runner.
Yeah, and something they'll have to continue to keep as a point of emphasis, playing Hurts next week.
Who's
obviously mobile. So I definitely agree with you. I think they were more afraid of Herbert than his rushing totals and everything to leading up to this game may have told you, because he has been scrambling a good bit. He's been comfortable pulling the ball down. I mean, we even saw it on the touchdown run, but he's been doing a good bit of that. And he, has decent wheels. So he's definitely, I can understand wanting to keep those lanes controlled.
All right, simulated pressures back up to 6 this week. They've been very low in terms of those last few weeks. 24 yards on his plays, so 4.0 yards per play. Nothing wrong with that, obviously. It's very good. And they had 2+ elements on 4 plays, which is they haven't been having much at all recently, because it's usually been a stunt or a blitz or a simulated pressure, but not combinations of them. Van Noy led the team. Not Van Noy. Who led the team? I'm looking at this, but I can tell this is last week's total that I've got here. Okay, well, I'm going to point people to the article and say, if you look there, you'll see who the pressures came from. Yeah, Matabike had actually 4 as I scored it, and Van Noy had three, 1.5 pressures and a sack minus 8. And Owe had an interesting game. We'll probably talk about that a little later, but he had a multitude of different ways where he got 1 sack on cleanup and then missed a lot of other opportunities for sacks that were a darn shame. So he had, I thought, a very good game as well, even though he's facing a pretty top left tackle in Slater.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, Alec, individual player discussion time. Who would you like to talk about?
Well, let's talk about Harrison. Obviously, we've already spoken about him a good bit on this show, outside versatility and things of that nature. I was very surprised to see, and maybe kind of like parlays into the Trent Simpson. I was surprised to see the mix of linebackers in this game. And first of all, Welsh is out there the first play, and I'm like, whoa, that's wild.
Weird.
Well, yeah, and the Ravens figured out that was weird too. Eventually, he got 8% of his snaps in the first 23 snaps per Yoshi. So
they were all in the every snap of his was in the first half. He didn't play in the second half.
Right. Yeah. So he got his snaps out of the way early, so to speak, and then they transitioned over to Chris Board, Harrison, and Simpson taking on the roles. I was surprised to see Harrison in there as much as he was in lieu of even Simpson, for instance, where they had Board in. And I was curious. I saw, it's one of the film site mailbag questions, but I did think that was interesting, and I'm wondering if it's a data point going forward. I really don't have much of a take on that. I feel like Trent Simpson's played well this year, and I wouldn't want to start stealing snaps away from him for a guy like Chris Board. And even, honestly, even Malik Harrison, we kind of saw that experiment earlier on in the year when earlier on he was getting more snaps next to Roquan, and then they transitioned away from that. I don't think this game really will change that math, but I do think it is interesting, and it wouldn't surprise me if it changes something, but I feel like it won't.
Yeah, a lot is going on here on the short week, so I thought it might have something to do with load management to try and a player like Harrison, for example, played just a ton of snaps in this game, 73 snaps between special teams and defense, the most he's ever played. I wouldn't surprise me if they were making a concerted effort actually to conserve him for next week's game against the Eagles. And that last drive, he only played one snap, so I hope he wasn't hurt, because he came back into the game for. Yeah, for the final snap on first and one. So I don't think he was hurt.
Yeah.
So it probably, if anything, was just a load management thing that they really want to try and play a player like Board there. And you know, gives you a decent pass defense, so that's what you want anyway. He was the guy they were using on third down a lot. It was an unexpected change. And if I were you, and I think you're kind of hinting at this, that you might have expected to see Simpson in what would have been the Mike role with whatever around that, or the whatever you want to call it, the lone outside linebacker role. It kind of loses some of the obvious.
I thought his snaps would be more insulated than they were, and he ended up being one of the lowest snap getters at linebacker. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That is surprising in a game like this. And I thought he might have been hurt early on when we saw some other players getting inside linebacker time in place of him. So that happened it was basically happening on an alternating basis in the first half, that Board got the snaps on the second and fourth and fifth drives, and Simpson got the snaps on the first and third drives. And then in the second half, it was even more varied on a play-by-play basis. And then Board got the final drive of the game. So it was an odd split of snaps. It was very odd. And I don't think it says anything good about what they think about Trenton Simpson and as relative coverage ability to Board. And I also don't think Board is anything special in that category.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the load management piece you brought up is interesting. I wouldn't have expected that going into it. I mean, it is a short week, but like I said, I felt like Simpson's snaps were relatively insulated. I mean, he typically has more snaps in a given game, and he had less in this game when they were down linebacker. So just, it was very surprising.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Who do I want to talk about? Let's talk about Ajabo and Isaac really briefly. We hit on this last week, but Ajabo, a healthy scratch for the second consecutive game. Isaac activated and not played that much. And that has a secondary implication to me. So Isaac only saw five snaps in the game before the final drive of the game, and then he had nine more. Mm-hmm. Okay. And even in the second to last drive of the game, he had two of those five snaps. What you're saying by association there, I think association or commutation, whatever the term would be that's appropriate here, is that you didn't really expect Ajabo to get on the field any more than that. Because this is certainly a game where you need all hands on deck to beat an AFC wild card contender that you need to head to head against. It's not a simple matter like it might be against the Giants of wanting to try and get a guy out there who you haven't really seen very much of so far, which Sir Isaac certainly meets that standard. Of course, Ajabo also meets that standard at that. It's a matter of they really like him better.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a wild circumstance with Ajabo. Kind of like you mentioned in the last episode, sort of like a Cleveland saga, where in the action he has seen, there's been flashes, there's been like reasons for optimism, but for whatever reason, he cannot get a steady, you know, opportunity. Obviously, the injuries completely stifled his early career and his early opportunities in the first few years, but I don't know what's going on now. And it's super disappointing. I mean, I'll never forget sitting on draft night watching and saying, this is Pickens. This is the Pickens pick. And obviously, like, he has character concerns, and it's something that, you know, the Ravens typically have strayed away from. But we're seeing that success, obviously, in Pittsburgh now, and it's kind of frustrating when you have a guy, Ojabo, who came and see the field, even when now healthy. And yeah, it just feels like a failed experiment at this point. You know, there is opportunity for him to step it up next year, but, you know, similar to the conversation we had last episode about Williams, I think at this point his percentage is extremely low of finding an opportunity to impress.
Right. I would agree. I don't even think he necessarily is has a spot on the team next year. I think, you know, they're at a point where they might try and trade him, not seeing a trade partner, they might release him. And a lot of that will be dependent upon who they get in the draft. But, you know, hey, whoever they get in the draft is going to have a full hourglass worth of sand left. And Ajabo is down to his last quarter tank or quarter hourglass, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. So he's not a guy you necessarily have to bet on even next year.
I mean, look at Tavius Robinson, for instance. This guy is he's like one of those definitional play like a Ravens guys. Mm-hmm. He'll do anything that he's asked to do. He just has a high motor. And he's clearly ahead on the depth chart, right? It's not even close. Yep. And it's frustrating when you think about all the raw tools that Jabba has and how special he could have been, right? Like, Davis Robinson's not that. We know that. That's not what we expect him to be. But he's much clearly has a roster spot over Ojabo, and it's just it's wild.
And it's I don't think at this point, I mean, ceiling and floor have to be adjusted for Ojabo, both ceiling and floor. So yeah. Ceiling is much lower, floor is much lower as well. I'm not sure that my expectation wouldn't be that Tavius Robinson has more left in his career than Ojabo at this point. In fact, you know, being a second year player versus a third year player, that alone is a significant difference. And obviously Robinson's playing as a much bigger component of the Ravens defense right now is very strong evidence that he has more left in his career than Ojabo.
Yeah. I mean, Robinson seems like a guy who's going to get a second contract at some level.
Right.
And he's going to be a player in the NFL for, you know, 8 to 10 years. And right now Ojabo, it's unclear if he'll have a second opportunity after the Ravens.
Right. Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. And by the way, if you're looking at reasons why Isaac might have been active over a job, but one other reason is the special teams thing. So I don't want to shortcut that. And this is actually a position where I'm fine with them making the decision on special teams, because I just don't think I don't think either player is so exceptional in terms of what they're going to provide the Ravens pass rush in a game like this.
Yeah,
that you don't look at second at special teams as a fairly important characteristic of what you're getting out of them.
Is it my turn?
Yep.
Let's talk about Tre'Davious White. We mentioned last episode, 52% of the snaps in this game. I am grateful of the trades. You know, when they first happened, I was a little colder on Tre'Davious White relative, even though I didn't quite see how Deontay Johnson would have impact. In a way, I was more concerned about wide receiver depth than corner depth, because I felt like we were getting some of the horses back. This was before I think our Darius Washington was relegated to a safety role. You know, it wasn't as big of a thing. And also I heard bad reports about what he had left in the tank. Mm-hmm. Well, he gets on the field and it's been different. You know, he's been playing quite well. And not saying, you know, he's a blowaway talent. He's not what he once was, but he is contributing. He has good ball skills. I mean, it's a night and day difference compared to the Stevens as far as his ability to track the ball and make a play on the ball. And I'm excited to see his role continue to grow. I mean, that's what they're saying. You know, that's what, if you believe Harbaugh, he's saying that his role will continue to grow. And that is not surprising to me. I feel like he is outplaying Stevens at this exact moment, but not so much so that it's, you know, I think a rotation's valid at this point.
Right.
And this it's huge because, I mean, as much as JAD might have a couple plays here and there, I'm way more comfortable with what I'm seeing out of Tre'Davious White than JAD. And we know corners, just like wide receivers, are these hot rods, and you need as many as you can have.
And isn't, I think what you just said, the last is probably the most significant component to this. If the Ravens are going to play a four corner dime,
right,
they need to have five corners available.
Yep.
Okay. And so you got to have a backup, because if you lose a guy during the game, you can't be put in a position where you can't do it. So Tre'Davious White, outplaying JAD is really the key consideration. There's plenty of playing time with the amount of four corner dime the Ravens are now getting themselves into. There's and the lack of safeties, frankly, that they have right now. to make sure that all those guys get playing time. We just saw it in this last game where they played, you know, 3.11 corner snaps per play, which is just an absurd total. I mean, you know, if you play nickel every single play, you only have 3.0,
that's right.
But
that's
you know, this is higher than that. And, you know, I don't think there's any problem getting players time. I don't think there's any shortage of players you might want load management. You might have load management concerns for. I think that could be true of White with his recent injury thing. I think it could be true of Stevens in terms of trying to figure out what's not going right at a particular time, or maybe what matchup you don't like. And I think it's true of Humphrey in terms of the need to keep him healthy. We'd love to have Marlon Humphrey on the field for every single play and maybe on both sides of the ball, damn it, and special teams as well, but we can't do that.
Right.
You know, he's probably got to take some snaps off on defense. And anyway, I'm very happy with I can't ever remember a time when the Ravens had five corners that I was this happy with the depth with.
Right. I mean, last year they were pretty good too, you know. Rocket Sin was not the best, but Darby was playing quite well. And then obviously, you know, Marlowe had his injuries. So I think maybe this year. And we're not even talking about Millette here, who if he comes back and is healthy, he's a solid piece.
He's the guy I'm not sure there's playing time for when he comes back. Because I think they've committed. They've got guys that are good on the outside, and they're committed to playing Humphrey in the slot.
The slot, yeah.
I think he's actually the weakest link in what's going on right now. And I know the Ravens probably love Mollett. They have a like for him that's much greater than I do. I think he's another guy that could, you know, if an injury happens, you're going to be really happy you have him.
Yeah.
But I don't think he's the piece you can't live without in any case. And I love the fact that the Ravens' main options at slot corner have been Hamilton, number one, Humphrey, number two this year for almost all the entire year. And then now that Mollett has been hurt again, they've had guys, you know, when the other team lines up 2x2 and the Ravens are in their dime package, they then have Stevens and Humphrey in the slot. And they've shown the willingness to blitz from either side on that. I love that as a potential weapon to use against whatever opponent you've got. If you have Mollett has blitzed effectively. I wouldn't count on him to cover the way that either Humphrey or Stevens would.
I could see him finding playing time on the four corner dime that they've been running, you know, on the inside.
Okay.
But I agree with you entirely that given the versatility that JAD gives you, he would probably win out over Mollett in this current flavor of the Ravens defense.
Okay. All right. So inside outside versatility, you're thinking, or you're thinking special teams versatility? How specifically with
I was thinking more so on he has outside a bit. Like I think that we have enough cooks in the kitchen on the inside, but we don't have as many outside guys.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, there's most teams in the history of football, that's the way it goes. Like the 2023 Ravens are one of the first few teams one of the few teams I've ever seen that really had trouble finding the right guy for slot corner.
Yeah.
And the Ravens as an organization are very forward thinking, and they tend to accumulate outside corners of aircraft carrier size, and the slot corner will work itself out. Or if you need one on the fly, you can get a slot corner. You can't find an outside corner in December to save your life.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
If you're a facilities manager at a university, you know students rely on the cafeteria for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and the occasional late-night snack. So when a dishwasher breaks down and dirty plates pile up, the mess hall can turn messy in the blink of an eye. Enter Grainger. With over a million industrial-grade products and fast delivery, the product you need now is never far away. So you can turn that dishwasher back into a lean, clean washing machine. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Right. Yep. Sure can't.
All right. Let me pick on another player here. We've talked about a lot of these guys. I want to talk about Adafi Owe, because yeah. I thought he had another fine game. It was not an easy matchup for him. And let me bring up my notes on him here. It was not an easy matchup for him, but I thought he was very effective. And he came close on several sacks in this game. He drew two holding calls in this game. One was on Alt and the other was on Slater. The one on Slater happened to be the play that Van Noy got his sack minus eight, but it was a really nice insurance policy on that play. That got thrown. Then he bulled Alt right into Herbert and drew an offensive holding on that play where Herbert took off for 12 yards and that got brought back. And that was a nice delay tactic on that final drive where they ended up scoring the touchdown anyway. He was in there for the sack minus three he had. There was initial pressure from Broderick Washington on that play. I got the wrong play. The sack he had, there was initial pressure on the play, and he cleaned it up. It was Harrison who got the initial pressure, and then he cleaned it up for S minus three. Then he lost a sack of S minus three to a very close offsides flag. He definitely moved into the neutral zone. I'm not sure he wasn't back. But definitely he'd also held himself up, and Washington had to get in there first, and then he cleaned it up.
The officiating crew on this team had, going into the game, there were like the least flags in a game. and that could be true, right? Because one thing I'll give them credit for is they had a lot of low conferences to try to get things right, and I respect that. But there were a lot of these like ticky tag on the margin penalties. Like I felt like a lot of the penalties were kind of on the margin. You look at some of the pass interferences. You look at the leg whip. That was a like 30 some yard net swing.
Marginal call there.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of like little ones, but then, we get bailed out once or twice. So, you win some, you lose some with it. I hate officiating. It's something I would love to talk about maybe in the off season with you. The state of officiating, I think, is absolutely putrid in the NFL. And I think there's some easy things you could do to fix it, but yet here we are. So
to finish up with Owe, he also had a missed sack when Stevens ended up cleaning it up. And that went to your point. I think, I don't remember if you made that in this first episode or in this one, about the Ravens having some decent missed tackles where they retrack a ball carrier and it still sets, even though it's a missed tackle, it sets it up for somebody else. But I thought that was a really nice setup of Stevens on that sack minus four. If you look at Owe's overall productivity, it's very strange. And this goes in line with the Chargers as well and their low number of pressures and relatively high number of sacks. Owe's pass rush productivity is off significantly in 2024. 2023, he was in about the 83rd percentile of edges for the PFF stat pass rush productivity. And this year, he's in the 41st percentile.
Ooh. Okay.
Now, that's in part a function of the fact that Jones and Pierce haven't been healthy. They didn't have any problem with that the whole last year. All five guys played every single defensive line snap. It meant they basically always had Jones or Pierce on the field. Okay, and that was unbelievable boon to the pass rush. It showed up in 60 sacks. Everybody says it was all Clowney. It was all this. It was all that. I mean, I think the defensive line on the interior had as much of an impact on that as anything. And I'm not talking about Madubuike. I'm really talking about those two guys, Jones and Pierce, and how they drive the pass rush from the inside. So he's had a drop off in terms of what he's done. He's also having a career high in sacks and other quarterback hits, both of those numbers, which means he's finishing a lot more this year than he had previously. And yes, I'd probably take more pressures and a few fewer sacks if I had my druthers. But I think the only thing I ever hear about is his sack total. And I just say that people who are extremely into sacks over pressures tend to be more results based. I think you're losing out on something that is a key indicator for the future. And honestly, it's one of the things that I think other teams will look at and probably drop what their offer would be for Owe a little bit based on the low pressure total. And I like him a lot. I'm very bullish on Adafe. I've been the whole year. He has not had as good a year as he did in 23. Not even close.
Yeah. I wonder how it impacts his ability to maybe get a extension instead of actually playing the fifth year out at the market rate. Yeah, I guess we'll see.
I'm all for that in terms of, that's exactly what the fifth year extension is supposed to do, is give you an extra chance to sign your superstar first contract players with an extra negotiating landing strip effectively mm-hmm. that encourages both sides to come to make a deal. So, I'm still all for it. I think pass rushers are hard to get. I think Owe is a good one. He has not had the best year. And I think my kind of take on the situation that is, it's more about the interior pass rush. Those two guys coming from closest to one in terms of tech are the ones who are really haven't done as good a job and will be they need their healthy. They need them back. They need them back healthy.
Yeah. I mean, football is the ultimate team sport, and look no further than the linemen on either side of the ball as far as how ecosystem really can depend on performance of any given player. And I think you put it quite well. Not having those interior guys consistently available and healthy is impacting the outside guys tremendously.
Right.
All right. Let's see. Who do I want to talk about? I want to talk about Wiggins.
Okay.
Wiggins really impressed me in this game yet again. Like I mentioned earlier in the first episode, his ability to close and trust his makeup speed, not necessarily just to make up, but to create impact, like almost to bait, right? To bait a quarterback into making a pass that isn't really going to do much for him is impressive. His ball skills are good. I've been really impressed with the guy. I think it's a phenomenal first season for him, and I'm grateful how the draft worked out. To Costa mentioned, he felt like going corner tackle was the best way to get the best out of those two positions. And if he waited on corner, he went tackle first and waited on corner, he was quite worried about the level of corner quality. And we did see that play out. You never know how these butterfly effects could be, but the first, mid-30s to 50s picks were all, like, a lot of corners went. Similarly, those corners and wide receivers again, So I definitely think Costa was smart with the way he did that, and I could see Wiggins being a guy who's here for, 10, 11 years. I mean, he's looking like the real deal.
Yeah, I don't know that I ever predict a 10 or 11 year career with one team as being great, but I agree with you. I'm very happy with that. And what's been really nice about this first year is that they haven't had any problem getting him on the field for significant snaps. I feel like also there's been kind of a ramp up in it. They've wanted to get him on the field in the nickel, and they've been, let's put it bluntly, they've been kind of fortunate to have Mollett out where Mollett was not hogging playing time at nickel, and they could move Humphrey over there.
Right.
And use Hamilton and Dime and whatnot. And that allowed for space for Wiggins to be on the field. He's too good not to figure out what you have there. He has too much upside for you not to figure it out in year one. And yes, he's not Tyler Linderbaum, where you install him at center in the first year. And he's not Hamilton, where he wins his job. He's not yet Hamilton anyway, where he wins his job during year one and you can't get him off the field all of a sudden.
Yeah.
But I think he is a guy who by the end of this year, we're going to say we should never have a snap where this guy's not on the field.
I'm already there, Ken. I really do feel like he's clearly the corner two, and it's not even close. It's one of those things where because of the slot, the need for nickel and all that, I can see how, Humphrey's going to be in the slot a lot. And then you might not get to 100% with Wiggins because of what you have in Stevens and Tre'Davious White. But I really do think it's getting mighty close. I'm already there, but I can see how it's not quite there yet for the coaching staff of just saying, Wiggins, you've won this job. it's you. Because he's got the upside, and I think he's playing quite well.
I think I'll tell you what would do it for me entirely is there are teams like the Dolphins, the Bengals still a little bit because they still play some 12 personnel that have two stud receivers they can put on the field and not much in the way of a third receiver.
Yeah.
If when that team is a team you may want to chase, no pun intended, in terms of going after the other team's number one receiver in a specific way. And I think the typical way I like doing it is put your number two cornerback or put your guy with your second best coverage characteristics. Actually, let's change that. Put Marlon Humphrey on the other team's number two wide receiver and let him handle that on an island. Yeah. And send Wiggins over to the other guy who's the constant problem, the constant thorn in your side. In this case, it would be Chasey Chases, and put him on that with help. And then you constantly are siding up a safety on that side of the field. I remember going to the 2009 AFC wild card at New England. And one thing they did right away in that game was they said, we're putting Ed Reed over the top on Randy Moss's side. Now you just think about Ed Reed and his entire career as this freelancing, unbelievable ball hawk, safety. You shouldn't be ever telling him where to go. He knows where to go, you know, and yet in that game, they decided that's our best way to try and win the football game is to try and make sure Randy Moss has the most dangerous looking bracket right over him. And if Brady's reading his wristband during the play and it says fine 20 on every play, you know, as you've seen famously from the picture, and his and the underneath cornerback is there and is something as well. And I you know, it might have been Dominique Foxworth or somebody back then at this time. Wouldn't have been anybody really great that you would have had an opportunity to bracket him pretty effectively. But anyway, I thought that was I think that's one of the ways if the Ravens go to a traveling system that they go chasing the other team's number one receiver, then I think Wiggins doing it is a potentially outstanding solution.
For sure. Who you want to talk about, Ken?
Let's see. I think I want to move on and do some questions from the mailbag. We're kind of far into the show here. I want to make sure we have enough because I know we had a few here, and I know we had someone read it as well. Do you happen to bring it up in terms of the hashtag film study mailbag, and maybe you go through those questions? I'm going to quickly slip over to Reddit and find the ones from there.
Yeah, I'll throw this one to you. We kind of talked about it a little bit earlier, but from Greg McGowan, we're looking at what is it going to take for the D to run more stunts? Van Noy's sack was on a stunt last night.
Yeah, first of all, beautiful stunt from Van Noy. And the guy who needs to be really recognized on this is Matabike's pick was unbelievably good. So when you have an under player like Matabike, and Jones, by the way, is that kind of player too. The Ravens are blessed with interior defensive linemen who have a lot of capability on stunts. They can jam their body between two offensive linemen where each of them has half the block on them. And then as soon as you have a peeler to either side, that creates an opportunity for the under player as well. And Matabike and Jones are both big threats to beat that kind of a half-ass block or half block you get when the looper comes through. In this particular case, Van Noy came around through the A-gap, and Pipkins was way too slow coming off of Matabike. And part of that was just the pressure Matabike was putting on that situation at the time. And part of it was also Pipkins' processing was not up to the task in that particular case. But great stunt. And Brad, you're asking, like, how do they do more stunts? Well, they've got to blitz a little less to do more stunts. And they also probably have to play some quarterbacks that they're willing to let them escape from the pocket. So those are the two things. They weren't willing to do it with either Herbert or Wilson. And Josh, you already made the point, they probably won't do it with Hurts as well. So I think it's going to probably be a low stunt game against Philadelphia next week as well.
I agree. The next one is from A Bits Bost. He asks, what will we have to see from our Darius Washington at safety for the remainder of the year to not consider using a high pick on a safety in the 25 draft? Do you think safety is on the table in the top 2 to 3 rounds, regardless of his level of play?
I'm going to say yes, but why don't you answer the question first in terms of what are the characteristics in a safety you'd want if you're drafting him that high?
Well, I mean, if you're drafting that high, you definitely want a free safety type, right? I want an impact player at that level. You know, I think the Ravens' strategy of taking, you know, BPA in those first few rounds is pretty good. You know, sometimes they don't get the necessarily high positional value guys. I mean, and safety is one of those positions for what it's worth. But you're looking at what you're getting out of Simpson. You're looking at, I mean, Travis Jones. I think that is a premium position, but he was a nice get at the third round.
Matty Bique.
Yeah, Matty Bique.
Cheap as hell in the third round, yeah.
Yeah, Matty Bique was phenomenal in the third round as well. Great call out. I would say, you know, it has, like I said, it has to be a free safety. I would honestly want to be finding a guy who reminds me of Kyle Hamilton in the ability to move him down into the box as well. I just want to see a very positionless player that gives the defense versatility. That's what I would look for out of a top, you know, three round, you know, day two, day one pick.
Okay, so I'm going to address that component of it. I recognize the fact that I cannot have Superman in every draft pick I make. Sure. So they drafted Kyle Hamilton, 14th overall. He's the ultimate guy who appears to be, you can move him wherever you want, linebacker, you know, slot corner, strong safety, free safety, and you can play them all effectively. Yeah. I don't need that kind of versatility. The versatility, air quotes, that I want to avoid is having multiple strong safeties and trying to fit those square pegs into a round hole to get my free safety needs taken care of. Yep. So basically, the trend you need to continually fight in drafting safeties is avoiding having a position where you don't really have free safety talent. And where the hell are we right now in 2024? Our free safety talent that we were depending on to start the year is gone.
Yeah.
Marcus Williams isn't the player he was. Eddie Jackson has already been cut for good riddance. The Ravens are very fortunate that they have guys who probably are strong safety / slot corners who they moved into the back end and seem to be getting the job done right now. But it's a little bit, you know, I want to have more of a, you know, the Lord of the Nazgul on the back end who every quarterback is afraid of throwing anywhere within, you know, 20 yards of him.
Yeah. Well, here's if we're just trying to map names, I knew that going into this draft, there's a guy that's a top 10 prospect for many people at safety, Malachi Starks, right? Out of Georgia. You know, if he somehow falls to late 30s, you know, and the Ravens are picking there, you know, snatch him up. That's not going to happen. But what I think is much more realistic, right? Yeah. Which I think is much more realistic is the kid out of South Carolina, maybe. We're looking at Nick Emmanuari. And he actually kind of fits the skill set a little bit better where he's a big guy. He looks like a linebacker, but he has great closing speed and kind of plays like a cornerback in speed. I think that's a guy that I would go after in the late second round. You know what I mean? That's a pick that I could see the Ravens making. But what I mentioned earlier on is that apparently this is not a deep safety draft. So you might be looking kind of thin, and I don't want to reach is what I'm getting at. I do not want to reach for a safety in particular. It's just not the place to do it.
Well, it's been the second and third round where a lot of really good free safety picks have come up. Jesse Bates and others who fit the mold of a guy who is a good back end thing. I would be very narrow in terms of the characteristics I'm looking for. Free safety is the need. Do not lose sight of that.
Right.
Yes, if Superman happens to be available and he's a free safety, you can play wherever else you put him. Fine, no problem taking him. But I want. Be laser focused on making sure I get ball hockey characteristics that I can use at least on a split field roll on the back end.
There you go. I agree.
All right. I got a couple questions here from Reddit, and I appreciate you guys tossing in. So they don't have access to hashtag film study mailbag. You folks who do, please drop questions in on Twitter right there. Bufudu had a really more of a comment. He said, I wonder if this season will turn out to be a case study in the downstream effects of a bad safety tandem. I don't think it's a coincidence that Brandon Stevens is suddenly playing better now that his overtop help isn't a disaster. Very good point.
Yeah, that's a great point. Before the show started, I pulled up an infographic of one of those classic charts where the upper right-hand corner is where you want to see players, and Ardarius Washington and Hamilton are up there, and Williams and Jackson were on the lower middle line, and that's not what you want to see. Great point that Stevens is playing with more confidence, having a little bit more help on the back end, and you know, it makes a lot of sense for a guy who traditionally has the best ball skills when he has better help on the back end that he'd be performing better.
Yeah, I think it is a natural thing that, you know, you're already kind of a bailout, chase the spot of the football player, that if you have a little more confidence, then maybe you have a little bit more confidence to stick your foot in the ground when you think you see the back shoulder play happening.
Yep.
I think there are good reasons. Bufu'd a great point. Great point there. By the way, comments are good. We don't need always a question. I thought that was a good one. Got another one from Quicksilver 7837. He says, in addition, he doesn't use Twitter much, so he wanted to do it here. What is your opinion on the Ravens offense being so conservative on their final drive by just running the ball and milking the clock? I feel the Ravens have gotten burned in previous games by taking their foot off the gas too early. In your opinion, where's the threshold for going conservative versus staying aggressive in relation to the score and game time remaining? Okay, so basically, Ravens are up 14 and they burned the clock down to 3 minutes, and they also got a penalty, which was forcing them to make a decision between, you know, throwing the ball and trying to get the first down or just taking time off the clock. I thought it was entirely the correct move to just take time off the clock, give it back to LA. They hadn't proved they could move the ball after Dobbins got hurt at all. They did happen to move the ball down, got a touchdown with under a minute remaining. But the Ravens also, you know, got themselves in a position where they had to recover an onside kick at that point to have any chance to come back and win the game. And that's not a good position to be in if you're the team that needs that.
Right. Yeah, I think I err on aggressiveness, like we mentioned the first show. The thing that you brought up with the penalty is the biggest thing you have to talk about. I think if that penalty doesn't happen, the Chargers don't see the ball again. That really threw off everything because they were already, you know, leaning towards conservatism and leaning towards just run out the clock and make them use their timeouts and things of that nature. So yeah, I believe that was what killed us. Now, when we did have the penalty, I did think to myself, I would like to be a little bit more aggressive here. I would like to get the first down, I want to reset. I want to be able to end this game. But I think that's partially just, PTSD from, previous collapses. And because in reality, what you were seeing out of the team, like you mentioned, the inability to move the ball with Dobbins, and frankly, the cowardliness of, I mean, you know, eventually they start going for fourth down because they knew they had no other shot otherwise, but they just weren't, they didn't have the aggression that you thought, okay, this is going to translate quite well to the four down football they were running into. So, I would have been a little bit more aggressive, but I wasn't yelling at the TV that they simplified it there.
All right. Were there any others on Twitter? I didn't check back to see if there's one more.
There was nothing on Twitter other than asking about the impact on the absence of Marcus Williams.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. One snap. I don't think he's coming back. We talked about this during, the first episode. Is there any real chance that Marcus Williams comes back and plays snaps that the Ravens are happy with again? Because he can certainly get playing time if there's an injury. And your answer is 10, 15%?
Yep.
I think I'm right in the same place. And if they were to acquire Marcus May, which may happen tomorrow, that probably drops to about 3%, because I think that the chance that Marcus Williams has is due to injury. And it would, if somebody gets hurt, he gets on the field, then he plays well, then the Ravens could end up being happy. But I don't think he's going to, I think you made the point, is organically going to get an opportunity there.
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's all I see on Twitter.
MVP's 3-1. Do you want to do that with me on the defense here?
Sure. I got some guys.
All right. Who's your number three guy?
Number three for me will be Kyle Van Noy. Like you mentioned, was able to generate the sack, was also able to get the most pressures in this game, and I just noticed him a good bit on the field.
Okay, he's my number three guy also, but another guy I'll point to, you almost didn't see him in this game, is Kyle Hamilton. He's certainly made a couple of big plays. He did have a missed tackle in this game, which is, you know, it's going to happen. But he still kind of imposes his will near the line of scrimmage in some ways, even though he's playing free safety. And I think the fact that the Ravens had such a good game against Herbert, despite giving him a lot of ample time and space, Hamilton has to get a share of that credit, a commission share of that credit, just by the fact that he's the free safety.
Yep. No, great call out with Kyle Hamilton. I did realize while we were talking today that we mentioned him more as a piece of the other guys. Like we talked a lot more about the other guys and what he was able to enable. But yeah, he definitely contributed a big way on this game. I love seeing him creep down. It is exciting in a way. I feel like that is something we're gaining, is that we didn't see too many plays where Kyle Hamilton was lined up deep and he would creep up in the previous iteration of the defense, but now they're just like, they got to get it out of their system, right? So they're doing more of that.
Right. Number two guy for you.
Number two for me will be Malik Harrison. Like I said, you know, that missing the gap and allowing the 17-yard run to Dobbins was really painful and had me worried, but he made up for it in other impact plays behind the line of scrimmage. And like we mentioned the first episode, his ability to play on the inside and the outside throughout the game and the versatility that gave the defense, be able to mix and match board in there as well. Pretty darn impressive. Cool way to see them make up for the fact that they lost Roquan.
Harrison, way up the top of my list at number one. He had eight stops and two missed tackles in this game, and that's as good as you can ever expect any inside linebacker to be. Roquan is about that for the year, I think. Trenton Simpson might be about that for the year. Roquan might be a little bit better in terms of the stop to missed tackle rate. Just a terrific game out of Harrison. I mean, he had the game of his career at exactly the right time for that to come along for the Ravens. It's just a wonderful confluence of circumstance here. Most snaps he's ever played. I can't imagine there's been any higher moment in his life to date than coming off this Monday Night Football game, yeah. Other than, you know, what maybe happened at Ohio State.
Yeah, for sure. Big game from him. Do you want to do your number two then?
Yeah, my number two guy was Adafi Oye. And Oye had a really nice game of getting pressures, draw two holding flags. That's tremendously underrated, by the way, folks. You draw holding calls, it's almost like getting a sack. It's declinable. In fact, one of them, there it was declined because Van Noy had an 8-yard sack on the play. On another one, they negated a Herbert RL12, which shows the other side of the value of that. And by the way, that's the reason why I have such a high weighting for penalties on the offensive line scoring system, is just how absolutely devastating they are to an offense. It's one of the major sources of variance that allows drives to get stalled. So Oye did great in that way. He did have a nice cleanup sack himself. He had other plays where he's close to getting a sack, was in there for pressure. Obviously one of those was an offsides of his own, which was, you know, it was a shame, but it was very close in terms of whether it should have been called offsides. I thought just a fine game for him. The last couple of weeks, he's been back and playing better with Jones healthy, kind of had a nadir in the season for a couple of weeks there with Jones out. And hopefully he's one of the players that you could point to on the defense who could get a little bit better the rest of the season and lead the Ravens hopefully on a Super Bowl run.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, like you mentioned, Oye has headroom to get more impact than what he's getting, you know, squeeze a little bit more out of his opportunity set. One thing that we talked about recently, and you weren't involved in this conversation, I'm curious your thoughts. What would you think of converting holding into a 5-yard penalty but a loss of down? Do you think that would make anything better or worse for the teams? Because the 10-yard penalties are pretty drive crushing. And I don't know if...
I think 5 yards and lost down might be worse.
I think so. I think it might be too. Yeah. I don't know if that's the solution either, but it was interesting to think about.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I can remember something. Dan Reese was on the show, and he had some great data he'd worked with to go through what the holding penalty on first down equivalent was. It was like first and 20. The equivalent was second and 14. Okay. And that had to do with the 2019 Ravens offense. So it may have been specific to them, but it had to do with, you know, what was their chance of getting a first down under equivalent circumstances. And so I think if you're talking 5 yards and loss of down, it might be right in the same neighborhood, but I'd say for most teams, it's probably going to be even worse than a 10-yard penalty with no loss of down.
Yeah, I can believe it. It's just interesting because I feel like holds are so painful at times when you look at them, not just from what they impact the defense or the offense, but like the level of impact on the play. Sometimes it didn't matter at all. And it's just like, that's like the worst hold, you know, those are the worst holds to see and things of that nature.
Okay. Now this is a lot of Baltimore sports fans who are my age or probably older will remember this, but Super Bowl V, you know, the blooper bowl, 13-13 tie late in the game. The Ravens, Roy Hilton, who played right defensive end for the Colts in that Super Bowl, already had two sacks in the game. He rushed off that end on first down, and the Cowboys got tagged for a 25-yard holding penalty. It was a 15-yard penalty for holding back then, and plus it was a spot foul, so he was holding 10 yards behind the line of scrimmage.
Oh, no kidding.
And that brought up second and 35. And Tom Landry always called that next call the worst call, the worst play call of his entire career. Mike Curtis intercepted the ball, returned it. Three plays later, Jim O'Brien kicked the field goal, won the Super Bowl for the Colts. It's one of the really great moments in sports history. So the holding call has been through one iteration of reduction in nuclearness, in its thing. I think that might have been a 78 rule change. It might have come with the illegal contact stuff and all the other things, but it was definitely a improve offense within the game, because you had a lot of these absurdly, you know, you think holding penalties are drive killers now, go back to the, you know, 1972 and it was a lot worse.
Spot fouls is a really interesting way to do it. I think there might be something there. So anyways, my number
You're saying spot foul plus no additional yardage then.
Potentially I would want to workshop that. It might be like add 2 yards or something. Cause like you want to have a hold at the line of scrimmage be basically, you know, a redo, right. You know? Yeah. There have to be some sort of scalar.
Are you looking at this point in the history of football? Are you looking to add more offense or add more defense to the game?
For me, I would want to have more defense to the game. I like when there's more of a matchup. I feel like right now, the way the game's built, it makes a lot of sense investing in your offense more than your defense, just because of the way the game's built.
But me too, and I absolutely hate that.
Yeah. I mean, I think you want to at least be neutral, right? I think that's valuable. I think it makes for more interesting roster building. There's more paths to victory, so to speak, for teams, and just makes for more in a league that is all about parity. The schedule is built in a way to make more parity. Even like the order of the games is built to make more parity. You know, that's just another piece of the puzzle, right?
Yeah, and it's kind of an important piece of the puzzle. I feel like we're in a place like where baseball was in the mid 20s, and then maybe again during the steroid era of home runs are just going freaking crazy, and you know it's all that matters in the game, and it's totally reduced the value of other offensive elements you should be looking for. Now you're just looking for behemoths and put them on a program of androgen or whatever to bulk them up. But in the mid 20s, it wasn't a question of steroids; it was a question of the baseball liked what the home run did to repopularize the game then, or to expand the popularity of the game, and they let it go crazy. And all of a sudden you had all these guys hitting 50 plus home runs, and from 10 years earlier, having a dead ball era. Well, you know, there has to be a time we check that. And I think right now I'm bothered so much by the notion of what it means to have four down football in the hands of the other quarterback, even when we've got Lamar Jackson, that it makes it really a reduced fun to watch a game where your team has the lead. Yeah. And the balance of strategies already favor the trailing team in a lot of ways. There's no reason to create more where, you know, offense has such an advantage over defense that you have more games focused as coming down to the very final usage of time and game management that comes with that at the end of a game. It's just, I've never liked that about the NBA, that I think it comes down to the last 2 minutes too often.
For sure. I mean, and I don't see it changing because of the, you know, sports betting, fantasy football, like that, how that's increased popularity, to the game per se. Like I don't see it necessarily changing. I would love a little bit of a check, but I feel like they're always going to slightly favor the offense. I think it's a sexier product to sell.
Okay. All right, fair enough. Alec, always great talking football with you.
Nate Wiggins, my number one pick, by the way.
Oh, Nate Wiggins, your number one pick. Wow, okay.
Yeah.
All right, so that's an off the reservation pick, but a good one. He's kind of
he made me the happiest in this game. Like I was just he made a couple plays in this game where I was just pretty darn excited. And And that's why I think he elevated there for me.
I think that might have been the first time he's rushed the passer in this game too. But
and he looked like
he got a pressure. Yeah. And he looked like it. Yeah.
He didn't have quite the command of leverage and maintaining a rush lane there. Anyways, it was a pleasure talking football with you, Ken, as well. Definitely appreciate you having me on the show.
Tell us where they can find One Winning Pod and or talk to you online.
Yeah, sure. OneWinningPod.com is how you can find us. Number one, the numeral. And you can find me as well, alec.polianis.com on Blue Sky. And the show's on there as well. That's where I am online.
Still thinking about trying to get a Blue Sky account, but it's a pain in the ass, building a Twitter following and then.
Yeah, it's a mess, man. I completely agree. Kyle Barber's moved over and Mink has moved over. I don't think Jeff has, and it's a little bit less over there, but a lot of other sports accounts have moved over, which is nice to see. And I just love the fact that it's an actual algorithmic time or not an algorithmic timeline. It's a chronological. I can see all the darn things I follow. And I feel like I've been losing that for a while over on X.
All right. Fair enough. Other folks out there, really appreciate you listening. If you're at this point of the second podcast on the defense, I know you're a big fan of the show. I really appreciate that. If you want to do us a favor, write us a 50-word, 5-star review. Always appreciate that. Otherwise, just drop some questions in hashtag film study mailbag, and we'll look for that. If you can't get there for whatever reason, you can send them to me by email. You can put them out there on Reddit. You can in the offensive line or defensive articles, whichever you would like, and I'll try and make sure I get to them. But really, it is easiest to still get them on Twitter. I can sort them more easily that way. Mm-hmm. When you put a question out, it's more important that you put hashtag film study mailbag in it than it is that you get the whole question in your first tweet. I'd rather have half the question in your first tweet, hashtag film study mailbag, and then have a response to that, which has more of that question. So it's easier for me to follow it that way. But thank you very much for your questions. Really appreciate you, listeners. Alec, thanks again for coming on.
Thanks, Ken.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Americans are durable. We take pride in hard work and high quality. American Giant makes durable quality clothing right here in the USA, because what we wear reflects who we are. When you buy American Giant, you're not just wearing the best clothes money can buy, you're helping keep jobs and pride in your own backyard. Premium clothing built to last decades, like it should. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code RIGHTHERE24.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app.
Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.